I'm Anne Strainchamps, and lately I've been thinking about going to Mars. Well, not me, but maybe you. And not just because they found water on Mars, or because Matt Damon is there, but because of people like this.
I am Bas Lansdorp, and I am organizing a human mission to the planet Mars in the year 2023. This will be, I believe, the most exciting event in the history of humankind. Humans will now be a multi-planetary species.
Bas Lansdorp, Elon Musk, Buzz Aldrin, there are a lot of people right now seriously talking about getting humans to Mars. Here on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we'll meet some of them.
My roommate at the time told me about the story. They're offering a one-way trip to Mars for anybody. Anybody could apply, you know, anybody in the world. And we started asking people about this, just like our friends and people we knew. If you could go to Mars, but you could never come back, would you go? And it was like over 90% of the people we asked were like, no way, that's crazy. I really didn't think it was crazy. I thought it was a good idea.
Meade McClintock is 27 years old. She's got a degree in English and film, and she's loved science fiction since she was a kid. She's currently on the short list for Mars One, the project to send four people on a one-way trip to Mars. Meade, why would you want to do that?
I mean, isn't it really exciting? It's like, to me, it sounds very scary, but it also sounds like a really exciting adventure. And I think it's important for humanity. We need to keep pushing and keep exploring.
What's the scariest part when you think about it?
One of the things that really scared me was the idea of when you can't see Earth anymore, but you can't see Mars either. So you're just kind of in the middle of space. And hopefully you're, you know, going in the right direction and you're going to land at the point that you want to land at. But that to me is very scary.
And what do you imagine would be the best part? Like, if you sit around and fantasize about your future life on Mars, what do you imagine?
Well, I don't think it would be easy. I think it would require a lot of self-discipline. But, you know, I'm a film person, so I'm very much into stories and character. You have, like, a team mentality. You also have a little bit of cabin fever. You go through phases of, like, hating everybody on your crew and then, like, feeling really close and loving them and, like, just kind of waves of different, like, the ways that your relationships change. I think that would definitely happen.
You must think about this, fantasize about this. Do you have, and you're a filmmaker, so do you have kind of fantasies in your mind, scenes? I want you to paint me a picture.
The scene that I see is not necessarily out on the surface, but it's inside the habitat because that's where the settlement is. And I can see people a few years down the line, like when there's maybe three or four teams, and just all the different things that people are working on, that people are studying what we found, they're working on repairing, they're working on building, or maybe they're making art themselves. Maybe they're playing an instrument or reading. My favorite scenes in movies are the campfire scenes, right? Like, you have a big action scene, and then you have a scene where they're all sitting around the campfire, and they're telling their stories, and they're becoming closer. So that's always a scene that I see in my head.
So do you really, honestly think this is going to happen?
I think everybody has doubts, but I'm sure that in my lifetime I will see somebody go to Mars, whether it's me or whether it's somebody else. It's kind of, I think, the goal of our time with space. To me, it's not really a matter of, like, if it's going to happen. It's more like, when is it going to happen?
So at this point, how does your life here on Earth change? Aren't they saying you need to train for 10 years or something?
That's true. However, we still have another two selection rounds. So right now, I'm just kind of waiting and thinking, because for whoever goes, they're saying goodbye forever to everyone that they know other than the crew. and they're never going to be able to hug them again or anything like that. So,
what do your parents think?
They're both like, we're very proud of you, but we don't want you to go. My mother's more like, you know, I don't want you to go, but I think it would be amazing. And my father's like, I will kidnap you. You're not going.
Last question. Imagine that you've made it through all the selection rounds and you're sitting with your team on the rocket as it blasts off from Earth. You're leaving your home planet forever. What do you think will be going through your mind?
I think a prayer. Definitely a prayer. But also like a cheer, you know, like very excited. I don't know if it wouldn't be able to be words. It would be so many different things. It would be fear. It would be anticipation. It would be like, let's just get out of orbit and then take it from there. And it would be like, you know, confidence probably in my team. Because if you train with your team for 10 years, you know, they're your rock. You can rely on them. So I think it would be a mixture of those feelings.
Well, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Meade McCormick is one of 100 finalists chosen for Mars One, a nonprofit that hopes to send the first human mission to Mars. So let's say this happens. We actually do send people to Mars. There's no guarantee that the mission would be successful. It could be a disaster.
At around 4:30 a.m., our satellites detected a storm approaching the Ares 3 mission site on Mars. The storm had escalated to severe, and we had no choice but to abort the mission. But during the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney was killed.
That's a scene from the new blockbuster movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon.
This is Mark Watney, and I'm still alive, obviously.
The Martian is based on the best-selling novel by Andy Weir. It's the story of the very resourceful astronaut Mark Watney, whose struggle to survive on Mars hinges on his science and math skills, and also a whole lot of duct tape. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Weir to talk about the story behind the breakout novel and to hear Weir as astronaut Mark Watney.
So here's the situation. I'm stranded on Mars. I have no way to communicate with Hermes or Earth. Everyone thinks I'm dead. I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. If the oxygenator breaks down, I'll suffocate. If the water reclaimer breaks down, I'll die of thirst. If the hab breaches, I'll just kind of explode. If none of those things happen, I'll eventually run out of food and starve to death. So yeah, I'm screwed.
Yeah, that is a great setup to the situation.
Thanks.
How did you come up with the idea for writing this story about an astronaut who's stranded on Mars and has to figure out how to survive?
Well, I'm a space dork. I'm a big fan of manned and unmanned spaceflight. And I was sitting around at home imagining how could we do a manned Mars mission? Not for the purposes of telling a story, but just how could we do it? Just a thought experiment. And so I figured out, okay, here's how we get them there. Here's how we get them back. Here's how long they can stay. Then I started thinking, okay, we need to deal with, things that can go wrong. What if this breaks? What if that breaks? What if these two things break at the same time? How do we make sure that the crew doesn't die? And as I started to think about these scenarios, I started to realize, hey, this could make a good story. So I made an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of them.
This wasn't your job. This was just kind of what you do in your spare time, imagining disaster scenarios on Mars.
So at the time I wrote The Martian, I was a full-time computer programmer. I programmed computers for 25 years. I only quit last year because I was now able to make a living off of writing.
The thing that's remarkable about your story is it is full of science and math and engineering. I mean, your character, Mark Watney, who gets stranded on Mars, he's kind of like a MacGyver in a spacesuit.
Yep, pretty much. That's what I was going for.
You just sort of learned all this on your own then.
Tons and tons of research. I started with more than a layman's knowledge because it's been a hobby and a passion of mine my whole life, but I'm by no means an expert. I'm just an enthusiast.
So how would you describe your hero, Mark Watney?
He is obviously very intelligent, very resourceful, and he's got sort of a gallows humor going on all the time. He's a pretty funny guy. No matter how dire the situation gets, he just kind of like handles it and deals with it in an optimistic way.
So what is he up against? I mean, what are his biggest obstacles, his biggest challenges to be able to survive?
Well, Mars is very, very inhospitable. First off, there is practically no atmosphere, and what atmosphere there is almost entirely carbon dioxide. So it's roughly the same as being out in space. You have to have an EVA suit, a space suit on, anytime you're outside of your little base. The next problem is he's got equipment and supplies designed to last 31 days, and he's got to survive for a very long time. He figures out it'll be 4 years until the next manned Mars mission arrives, and if nothing else, he needs to survive for 4 years on 31 days' worth of supplies.
So how does he manage to do that?
Well, fortunately, our hero is a botanist, and he had some viable potatoes, some potatoes that could still be planted. And then so he just starts growing potatoes inside of his habitat.
Well, in effect, you go into some detail about how this is actually possible to basically start farming on Mars. But could you give us a taste of that from your book?
Sure. Log entry, Sol 25. Remember those old math questions you had in algebra class, where the water's entering a container at a certain rate and leaving at a different rate, and you need to figure out when it'll be empty? Well, that concept is critical to the Mark Watney Doesn't Die project I'm working on. I have plenty of multivitamins, over double what I need, and there's 5 times the minimum protein in each food pack, so careful rationing of portions takes care of my protein needs for at least 4 years. My general nutrition is taken care of, I just need calories. I need 1,500 calories every day. I have 400 days of food to start off with, so how many calories do I need to generate per day along the entire time period to stay alive for around 1,425 days? I'll spare you the math. The answer is about 1,100.
That's great. Gives you some sense of what he's up against. Now, I've read somewhere that you've described the story of survival as basically an extended math problem.
That's fair.
Now, there's some other things that he needs. I mean, oxygen. I mean, how does he get enough oxygen?
Well, fortunately, the HAB is equipped with an oxygenator. This is real technology, where it's just a device that uses energy to strip the carbon off of CO2 molecules. So the carbon dioxide that you exhale, the oxygenator pulls the carbon off and releases the oxygen.
And what about water? How does he get the water that he needs?
So the water that he needs for his own survival isn't a problem because the water system is also self-contained in recycling. So he urinates, and also, most people don't know this, you lose about as much water from your breath as you do from going to the bathroom. So if you ever notice, if you breathe on a mirror or something, you'll fog it up. Well, that's water vapor exiting through your lungs. The HAB has recycling. It has water purification systems, and there's really no way for the water to get out of the system because it's an airtight container. So he doesn't have any initial problems with water. However, to grow potatoes, he needs a lot more water than he started with. So he has to get kind of inventive on how to create more water.
And how does he do that?
Well, it's a complicated system, so he has to make it. And water's recipe is you take hydrogen and oxygen and burn them, and then the result is water.
So you have all the science in there, and as you've said, you did a ton of research to try to get it right. How important was that to you to get the science right?
Well, it was really important to me. See, I'm a science geek, and so it's painful for me when I'm watching science fiction and I see something that just breaks the rules. Now, what's weird is there's sort of what I call the uncanny valley of scientific accuracy. If you go way overboard and make stuff up that's just completely off the rails, then everyone will accept it. So you say, like, yeah, I've got a warp drive. It makes my ship go faster than light. Everyone's like, okay, no problem. But if you say, like, oh, I'm going to walk around on the moon without a spacesuit on just by holding my breath, everyone's like, no, you'll die. So it's kind of interesting that there's this region where you're kind of accurate, but not accurate enough, where you will really alienate the audience. And I was writing it for a small group of readers at the time when I was posting it to my website.
We should point this out. I mean, this was not originally published as a book. You were just publishing chapters on your own website, right? I mean, self-published.
Right. Initially, it was just a labor of love, and I was posting one chapter at a time to my website. And I'd post a new chapter every 6 or 8 weeks, and I'd get feedback from the readers. And it was cool. My readers are scientifically minded dorks like me, so they would point out any scientific errors in there. That was a great way to try to keep things accurate. No magical tech is allowed. If you start hand-waving on the physics and science in a story like this, then all the challenges go away. If you just say, oh, he uses his chemistry skills to make a thing that generates water or something like that, then all the drama goes away. But if you're accurate, if you actually show the math and show all your work, then it kind of illustrates how incredibly difficult this stuff is.
Yeah. And just to pick up the story of the publishing, I mean, this is kind of an astonishing story in itself. So you were just posting these chapters that you would write on your own website, and then my understanding is that there was enough demand that people wanted to be able to download this more. And so then you self-published on Amazon?
Yeah.
And then somehow you got a contract from a major book publisher.
Yeah. So an editor at Crown Publishing, a division of Random House, heard about it and wasn't sure whether or not to read it. And so he talked to a colleague of his who is a literary agent, said, like, I don't know if I should read this or what. And so the agent, David Fugate, said, well, I'll read it and I'll let you know. And then so David read it and he liked it. And then he said, like, hey, you need an agent? Earlier in life, I'd spent 3 years trying to get a literary agent and I couldn't get any interest. And then one comes knocking on my door. And then he's like, hey, you need an agent? And I'm like, sure. And so then David turned around to Julian and said, hey, Julian, how much are you going to pay us for this book?
What I heard was that in the same week, you got both a book contract and a movie contract.
Yeah, Fox came for the movie rights around the same time we were negotiating the book contract. And the two things were being negotiated at the same time. And we had verbal agreements on them 4 days apart.
Astonishing
story. It was a stressful
story.
Week. Yeah, it's awesome. It's like you daydream and fantasize about this stuff when you're writing, but you never think it's actually going to happen.
Do you mind my asking what those contracts were worth?
A little bit. Six figures for the book contract and higher six figures for the film contract.
So just an amazing story. I mean, from self-publishing on your website to a big Hollywood movie.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So what do scientists at NASA think of your book?
Oh, they love it. They love it. They rarely see a book that puts that much effort into scientific accuracy. So they completely forgive me for the areas where I'm wrong. Also, I'm sure that NASA as an entity likes the fact that, you know, they're portrayed in an extremely positive light. And they feel that it might reinvigorate interest in the space program.
Now, suppose there was a mission to Mars and you were offered a seat on that spacecraft. Would you go?
No, I would politely decline. I write about brave people. I'm not one of them. I don't have the right stuff.
I've heard that you are actually afraid of flying. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. And I'm getting better at it. I hadn't flown since 2007, but then NASA offered to give me several days of VIP tours at Johnson Space Center in Houston, and I live in Northern California. So pretty much the only way to get there is to fly. So I sucked it up and I flew.
Kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Space flight to Mars and you don't even like getting on an airplane.
Yeah, like I said, I'm a guy who sits around and imagines cool stuff. I don't actually do the cool stuff.
Andy Weir wrote The Martian, the best-selling book and now major motion picture. He talked with Steve Paulson. So could we actually go to Mars for real? You might be surprised to learn just how close we are. Coming up, we'll hear more. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's one thing to imagine sending people to Mars, but for the past few years, NASA has been quietly figuring out how to keep them alive up there.
They're looking at how to select a crew that will be able to survive for a long, isolated mission with limited contact from Earth because of the huge communication delays, and have them survive that mission without, you know, killing each other, basically.
Martha Lenio was the commander of one of NASA's high seas missions. This is a project designed to simulate life on Mars. And to do this, you have to think about this, she and five other people, the people on her crew, spent 8 months in an isolated 1,000-square-foot dome on the slope of the Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. It was pretty bleak.
There's no life anywhere. There's no, like, running water anywhere. It's very desolate. You're far from human populations. And every time you go outside, you're putting on a spacesuit so you don't feel like the sun on your skin or the wind on your skin ever. So you get that really, you know, you're removed from the environment, and everywhere you look, there's no life. So you get that very, like, Mars feeling.
Wait, you only went outside wearing a spacesuit?
Yes.
And there were six of you doing this, is that right?
Yep. Yep. When we kind of first got there, it didn't feel very Mars-like. It kind of felt like, you know, you're in a flat with your friends and you're just hanging out inside all the time. But as like we were in there longer and longer and all the communications are delayed and you still like it's everything is very all your food is still freeze dried and everything is just rocks around. It started to feel more and more Mars-like the longer we were in there.
Wow.
It's actually a very intense social situation because like there's just a few of us, but there's not very much space and the acoustics were such that you really could, it was hard to find privacy. Like if you're sitting, everyone had their own room, but even if you're sitting in your room, you could hear what's going on in the rest of the hab. So it was difficult to get privacy and time for yourself.
So as a commander, you were in charge of the crew morale, their mental and physical health. What particular challenges did you face? What were you most worried about?
For myself, I was most worried about like the food and the exercise, but those ended up being like some of the more fun bits of the mission because people were very creative with the food.
What kind of food did you have?
Like a Mars mission would last about 3 years. So everything has to be shelf stable for at least 3 years. So everything was either dehydrated or freeze-dried. Freeze-dried meats, freeze-dried vegetables, dehydrated fruits.
Did you have water?
It was limited. We had like a 1,000-gallon tank outside that would get refilled periodically. You know, you could take about 6 minutes of shower per week. Yeah, you kind of like gauged your when you would take a quick shower based on what workout we did. So if it was a cardio workout, most of us would shower that day too. If it was yoga, we're like, oh, yoga doesn't warrant a shower.
Wow. So I would think that one of the most challenging things would be living in this very confined space with this same tiny group of six people for eight months. I mean, you guys must have gotten sick of each other. Were there arguments and emotional ups and downs?
Not really till close to the end of the mission. When we finished the mission, we had 3 days of debrief and then we're out on our own again. So a lot of us had like quit jobs and gotten rid of our flats and stuff in order to be on this mission. And, you know, 3 days after the mission, all of a sudden we're all unemployed and homeless again. So you could kind of see people's mindsets start to focus on after the dome, as opposed to worrying about the maintaining good relationships with the people in the dome. So at that point in the mission, then I found it more difficult to manage the increased friction between people, I guess. But we all came out friends still at the end. So these are friends we'll probably have for life now.
What things did you find you missed most?
There was one survey that we did for NASA, like I think it was like once a day at the end of the day, and it asked what you're missing the most. Often it was just like sun and wind, the feeling of sun and wind on my skin. But then other times you just get like these cravings for random things back home. Like one day I just remember really missing trees, and another day I just missed YouTube. So I was like, oh, I wish I could just like look up cat videos or something today. Like, of course you miss like being able to actually talk with your family and friends in real time.
What was it like to reemerge? Did it seem overwhelming?
We are all pretty nervous just because we knew there'd be reporters and a lot of people around asking us questions. And we haven't seen anyone else for 8 months now. So we're just like worried that we'd get overwhelmed with like and overstimulated by everything going on. And I know like before we walked out, like I was shaking, like physically shaking. But the song, The Final Countdown, had kind of been like our mission theme throughout the mission. So we're like, oh, we'll start blasting The Final Countdown just before we come out. Like 5 minutes to eight in the morning, we started playing it. And then we were ready to come out. And we got a message from our principal investigator saying, the reporters aren't ready yet. You're going to have to play the song again. So we played it again and then again and again. And by the time we'd played it like six or seven times, I was like, okay, I'm not nervous anymore. I can go out and talk to people now. But yeah, then stepping out of the dome and just having like, it was like this beautiful morning, and to feel the sun and the wind on our skin again and just have this clear view across to Mauna Kea. Like we've been looking through these plastic masks and visors, and we've never had a clear view of anything outside for 8 months as well. Just to have that beautiful, clean, crisp morning. It was just amazing.
So if NASA comes back to you at some point and says, okay, we're putting the first crew together and for the first mission to Mars, and we'd like you along, would you go?
Yeah, I would love to. I think it's sick. You know, it's one of like the, it would be a great adventure and you get to explore something entirely new. So I think that really appeals to my sense of adventure.
What do you think would be the hardest part of an actual real mission to Mars as opposed to 8 months in a dome in Hawaii?
I think just like the physical effects that getting to Mars in microgravity would like physically have on your body. For 8 months in microgravity, like you'll lose bone mass and muscle mass and your eye muscles will atrophy a bit. So you might not be able to see as well. You're going to be exposed to like a lot of radiation. So hopefully in the next 10 or 15 years, they'll figure out more of those solutions. And by the time people are, they have all the like rockets and ships and everything ready to go, they'll have something for the biology worked out as well.
Martha Lenio is a solar engineer and the first woman to command a Mars simulation. She and her crew were part of NASA's third high seas mission. They got out in June 2015.
This is in contact with a test. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yes, it would be exciting to go to Mars, especially since they found water there. But is it really worth the effort and the billions of dollars it would cost? I mean, just because we can go doesn't mean we should. Aeronautics engineer Robert Zubrin is a prominent advocate for a human mission to Mars. He thinks there are lots of reasons to go, and he lays them out in his book, The Case for Mars. He told Charles Monroe Kane, we might wind up on the red planet sooner than you'd think.
We can't go to Mars tomorrow, but from a technological point of view, we are much closer to being able to send humans to Mars today than we were to being able to send men to the moon in 1961 when Kennedy started the moon program, and we were there 8 years later. Given decisive, courageous presidential leadership, we could be on Mars before the end of the next president's second term.
Is that going to happen?
I can't predict, but the potential is there. The only thing standing between us and that is the decision to do it or not.
So who's going to get us there? Elon Musk, Mars One, NASA, something we haven't considered yet. Who's going to get us there?
Well, looking at it from the present point of view, I think it's probably some combination of Elon Musk and NASA. We do need to have the political class, in particular a White House who's behind this, who will make this a national priority. And we do have to have NASA as part of it. There's all sorts of expertise there that is nowhere else in the world. But I think Elon Musk can play a very important role in reducing the cost of the mission. He's been developing space hardware at about 1/10 the development cost of that's been accepted in recent years. And since the main thing standing in the way of a Humans to Mars program is its prospective price tag, if people like Musk can help knock the price down, I think it would be much easier to get sold through Congress and the other relevant places.
So, okay, we're 8 years away from going to Mars. What do we need to do in the next 8 years to get us there?
Fundamentally, it's taking existing developed engineering techniques and developing new systems. The most obvious example is we need a heavy lift launch vehicle. We had one in the 1960s, the Saturn V. We could, in principle, recreate the Saturn V, but you do have to engineer it right.
Right.
Okay. The reentry system's already been developed. The Dragon capsule that SpaceX has developed is sufficient for reentering Earth from Mars. We need to develop a landing system that could land a payload on Mars on the order of 30 tons or so. Right now, we have a system that can land 1 ton. That's what we landed with Curiosity. But we landed, 10-ton kind of objects on the moon in Apollo. We can develop this. We can develop things with bigger parachutes and so forth. This is all doable stuff. So from a knowledge point of view, from a scientific point of view, we're ready to begin a human exploration. But what we need is courage, vision. That's the missing ingredient here.
Why is this important then? I mean, they seem to not think it's important. Why is it important to you? Why should we colonize Mars?
Well, there's three reasons to send humans to Mars. One is the science. Mars is the Rosetta Stone for letting us know the truth about the potential prevalence and diversity of life in the universe. It was once a warm and wet planet. If the theory is true that life evolves wherever it has acceptable conditions, it should have appeared on Mars. And if it did, it means life is everywhere in the universe and probably intelligence too, because evolution takes lower forms to more complex forms with greater capabilities. We see that in the history of life on Earth. And this is something that thinking men and women have wondered about for thousands thousands of years, we can find it out by sending humans to Mars. The second is for the challenge. The humans to Mars be a tremendous, bracing, positive challenge for this country and every country that joins us in this enterprise, particularly to the youth. It would say to every young person, learn your science and you could be a pioneer of new worlds. And out of that, we would get millions of young scientists, engineers, inventors, technological entrepreneurs, doctors, medical researchers, the kind of people that drive progress forward, that drive society forward. And then finally, there is the future. If we do what we can do in this time, which is establish that first little Plymouth Rock settlement on Mars, then 200 years from now, there will be new branches of human civilization on Mars with their own culture, probably their own dialect, their own histories, their own literature, certainly many contributions to technology and invention. And you know what? These features that I'm describing to you, these were the characteristic of American frontier culture. We had Yankee ingenuity set loose, and you didn't have people saying, well, that's not the way we used to make shoes. And you say, no, there's a better way to make shoes. This is a better way to harvest crops. It's the American spirit. I think that the Martians will take this much further.
It seems like kind of like a white libertarian dream, you know, like, hey, let's go there. There's no red tape. Do whatever the hell we want. You know, get the biggest bulldozer we can build and just do what we want and play in our big sandbox. Is that going to include everyone?
You know, Roebling, he invented the modern suspension bridge. He designed the Brooklyn Bridge. And, you know, it's art. It's the Gothic cathedral of bridge building. You know what he said about it? He said, no one will be able to look upon it and not feel prouder to be human. We go to Mars. We take this barren desert and we make it bloom. You know, if ultimately, I mean, the ultimate vision of humans on Mars is to terraform the planet. Now, that's a little further out than just establishing a base there. But ultimately, that is what's implicit in humans going to Mars, to take a dead planet and bring it to life, make it bloom. And if turning a living planet into a dead desert is an act of environmental destruction, then turning a desert dead planet into a living planet is an enormous positive creative act. No one will be able to look on that and not feel prouder to be human.
You know, it's interesting hearing you say that. I'm thinking about, not that I would remember it, it's beyond my age, but when we first landed on the moon, humanity saw for the first time, literally saw, the Earth as a whole. And for many people, the modern environmental movement was born out of that. And for many people, there's a big inspiration. Yet, we didn't really change the Earth after that, did we? We still got a lot of problems, including the environment. Do you really see something like this really opening up our minds that much to change the Earth, people going to Mars?
Well, I do think that enabling people to take a global view was a positive step. Let's say we don't go to Mars. Let's say humanity accepts the notion that it is stuck on one planet forever with finite resources. Think of how unhealthy that is, because it immediately leads to the next question, which is who gets them? Is there going to be enough to go around? What about these Chinese that are developing? Is there going to be enough oil for them and us? Okay, maybe we should get ready for a fight. That's what that says, the closed future. On the other hand, the opening up of a new planet to human settlement is the most visible refutation of this concept than it can be. It shows that everything comes from human creativity.
All right, then. So what is your best guess? What year will humans land on Mars?
I think we'll probably land in the 2020s. You know, there was nothing destined about the moon landing. Kennedy didn't have to decide on a moon program. There were a lot of other ways he could have countered Soviet influence. He could have sent the Marines to Cuba, but he went orthogonally. He was visionary. He would say, we are going to astound the world what free people can do. And, you know, I was actually in Leningrad when we landed on the moon in 1969.
Wow.
And it did accomplish that. And the Russians, I know, they came up to me and, you know, punched me on the shoulder, Molodets, which is like attaboy. the leadership must have been having kittens, but the people got it. They understood this is what you want to be part of. This is what
right.
you want to be part of.
Robert Zubrin is an aeronautics engineer and the author of The Case for Mars. He talked with Charles Monroe Kane. So imagine you're on your way to Mars. What do you hear? Well, first, of course, the big blast off of the rockets. But then, once you clear Earth's atmosphere, it's just silence, right? All that emptiness and just you sitting in that little space capsule? Well, actually, no. Space may be empty and big, but It's got an audio landscape to it. Weird sounds show up out of nowhere, like this. This is the sound of electrons speeding along Earth's magnetic field. You can hear it from the Van Allen belt way out in space. And we have this sound thanks to Don Gurnett. He recorded space sounds for NASA for years and years and collected them.
Most people think of space as a vacuum, but in fact, there's considerable gas pressure there, much lower than here in the atmosphere and the surface of the Earth. But nonetheless, there is a gas out there. And astonishing variety of waves can propagate in this gas. And that's what I've spent a good part of my life studying with spacecraft there. I go out in space and we can detect these waves.
So imagine this, you're sitting in your little tiny space capsule, you're floating along quietly, and then you hear that, maybe just for a few minutes, and then it's gone. Wouldn't that freak you out? And there's more, and some of these sounds have names, like coming from Jupiter is the Jovian bow shock. Think of it as the bow of a ship cutting through water.
Now, to understand how these bow shocks occur in space, we first have to realize that there's a gas flowing out from the sun all the time. It's called the solar wind. In fact, it blows out from the sun by the Earth at nearly a million miles an hour. You usually don't know that down here in the surface of the Earth, but it's happening all the time. It produces effects on the Earth, for example, like the aurora. When this very high-speed wind runs into the magnetic field of, let's say, Jupiter or the Earth, it produces a shock wave out in front, just like when a supersonic airplane is going through the air. The reality really sinks in when you actually hear it, when you go through it. It's one thing to make plots of the velocity of the solar wind as you go through the shock. You can see the velocity decrease when you go through the shock wave. But I think these sounds just add a reality to it that you don't get any other way.
Oh, and also from Jupiter, the Jovian Whistler.
Whistlers are a very special wave phenomena that occurs near a planet. It's produced by lightning. What happens is when there's a lightning stroke in this ionized gas, this plasma that surrounds the planet, the high frequencies travel much faster than the low frequencies. So after a lightning stroke, you'll hear the high frequencies first, followed by lower and lower frequencies. So you hear a sound we call a whistler, which sort of sounds like this. It goes. I'd like to have you think about it in the following way. If you sit in a very quiet room, you really don't expect the molecules up in a corner of the room to suddenly get together and whistle at you. But strangely enough, this happens in this ionized gas that we call a plasma out there. Now, we, in fact, detected many whistlers as we flew by Jupiter, and this was the first evidence that Jupiter had lightning. It was the discovery of the first planet in our solar system, other than Earth, that had lightning.
So obviously, we love these sounds because we're audio geeks, but I think anybody would love them. If you want to hear more, Don Gurnett put a collection of his favorite sounds from space on our website. You can check them out there at ttbook.org. And coming up, science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson imagines the mother of all space trips, a 200-year voyage to another star system. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You could say Kim Stanley Robinson wrote the book on Mars. Actually, three books. His Mars trilogy is considered the classic hard science fiction account of settling and terraforming Mars. Well, now he's back with a new space odyssey called Aurora. And this one is a multi-generational journey to another star system, 12 light years away. Robinson recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the challenge of a long space voyage and the beauty of our own solar system.
Stan, how would you describe the basic story in Aurora?
It's the story of humanity trying to go to other star systems. This is an old idea. Tsiolkovsky, the Russian space scientist, said, Earth is humanity's cradle, but you're not meant to stay in your cradle forever. And the idea, which is out of science fiction ever since, that humanity will spread through the stars, through this galaxy at least, maybe further.
That's a long way to get to another star.
It's a long way. So I decided to try to tell that story to explore the difficulties and think about whether it's really possible at all, or are we really condemned, you might say, if you want to put it that way, to staying in this solar system.
Hmm. So what star are your space voyagers trying to get to?
They're trying to get to Tau Ceti, which has got a great Wikipedia article about it because it has often been the destination for science fiction voyagers before. Ursula Le Guin's Dispossessed takes place around Tau Ceti. Isaac Asimov's The Naked Sun takes place around Tau Ceti. It's about 12 light years away, and we know now that it has three or four big planets. They've got about the mass of about five Earths. And that's too heavy for humans to be on, but those planets could have moons about the size of Earth. So it becomes the nearest viable target, because Alpha Centauri, which is only four light years away, we know only has tiny little planets that are closer than Mercury to our sun, and they will not be habitable. And Alpha Centauri and Proxima Centauri, they're the wrong kind of stars anyway.
Your story is set, what, about 500 years into the future?
Right.
And it takes a long time to get to the star.
Yes. I guess my working principle was, what would it really be like? So no hyperspace, no warp drive, no magical thing that isn't going to really happen to get us there. So I postulated we could get spaceships going to about 1/10 the speed of light, which is extraordinarily fast. And then the problem also becomes you have to slow down. The mass of the decelerant fuel will be like 90% of the weight of your ship.
Really? But you're talking about a multi-generational voyage.
I mean, something
that's going to take a couple hundred years.
Yes.
I mean, which is a fascinating idea. So obviously the people who start out are going to be dead by the time you get there.
Yeah, I guessed it would take like four or five generations. And this is not an original idea to me. The multi-generational starship is an old science fiction idea. It's a sort of a subgenre within science fiction.
But the whole idea of a project that takes generations, I mean, we don't really do that anymore in our society. I mean, when people built the pyramids in Egypt, they did that, or the great cathedrals in Europe, sometimes these things would take hundreds of years. But I can't think of any project that takes generations anymore.
You have to think of it really as a mobile island or a vast zoo. So it isn't even a project so much as just a city that you've shot off into space. And what becomes interesting is to think about the people born on the starship who didn't make the choice to be there.
Yeah.
So it turned into a bit of a prison novel.
Because you're trapped there. You're trapped in this confined space for your whole life.
Yes. Yes. And for two or three generations, you're born on the ship, you die on the ship, you're just in between the stars. So there are some wonderful thought stimulants to thinking about a starship as a closed ecology.
How big is this starship in your story?
Well, I think there's something like 100 kilometers of interior space.
So this is big.
Yeah, two rings. You could imagine them as cylinders that have been linked until they make a circle. So 12 cylinders per circle. So you've got 24 cylinders, and each one has got a different Earth ecology in it, and each one of them is about 5 kilometers long. It's pretty big. But you need that much space to think of it as being viable at all, because you've got to take along a kind of Noah's Ark worth of genetic material, or else it isn't going to work.
What do you have to bring along? What is this Noah's Ark you're bringing?
In theory, you would want as much of everything as you can bring, but you certainly need a big bacterial load. You need to bring along a lot of soil. You need to bring along a lot of what would effectively be unidentified bacteria, that you just need a big hunk of earth. And then all the animals that you can fit that would survive, and have each one of these cylinders be a little zoo.
So as you were imagining this voyage, and as a writer, thinking about the imaginative possibilities of telling this story, which part of it is most interesting to you? Is it the science, trying to figure out, how technically we could get there? Or is it more the personal dynamics of being trapped in this space for so long and, how people get along?
I think it would be the latter. I'm an English major. The great starship narratives and the wing of science fiction that has discussed these ideas before has been the physics guys, the hard SF guys. And they've been concerned with propulsion, with navigation, with slowing down, with all the things that you would use physics to comprehend. But I've been thinking about the problem ecologically, sociologically, psychologically. And when you explore those, you get a new story. And as I say, it's a rather awful story.
Well, why is it awful?
Because they're trapped. And the spaceship is a trillion times smaller than Earth's surface. Even though it's big, it's small. And we weren't evolved to live in one of these things. In a way, it's like you spend your whole life in a Motel 6.
Okay, you put it that way. It does sound pretty awful.
Yeah. Better than a prison. But you can't get out. You can't choose to do something else. And I don't think we're meant for that, even though modern society, we live in rooms all the time. I think the reason people volunteer for like Mars One is they're thinking, how is that different from my ordinary life? I sit in a room in front of my laptop all day long. If I'm on Mars, it's even more interesting.
So you write about these long space voyages, but it sounds like you wouldn't especially want to be on one of them.
Well, not at all. And I've only written about long space voyages once in this book, Aurora.
Well, you also wrote a whole series about terraforming Mars. You got to get there.
Well, but I would make this distinction that Mars is another planet. You can get to Mars in a year's travel, and then you can live your whole life there, and you're on a planet. It's got gravity. It's got landscape. You can be terraforming it. It's like a gardening project or a cathedral building, and it's viable. It's doable. Going to the stars, however, is a completely different question because you would be traveling for several generations in a spaceship. In science fiction, it's been such a techie thing. It's been such an urban literature. People haven't de-stranded those two ideas. And they said, well, if we can go to Mars, we can go to Tau Ceti. It doesn't follow.
Would it be interesting to travel through our solar system? Is this an interesting place?
Yes. This solar system is, to my mind, our neighborhood. We can get around in it in human timescales. We can visit the moons of Saturn. We can visit Triton, the moon of Neptune. By and large, the solar system is our neighborhood, and it's fascinating. And I think if you're standing on the surface of, say, Europa, looking around the ice scape and looking up at Saturn in the sky overhead, it's going to be beautiful there, too.
I want to follow up on this notion of how beautiful it would be, because it just makes me wonder if we would develop a different sense of beauty if we were out there in the solar system. I mean, right now, when we think of beauty, I mean, putting aside man-made objects, we think of being in a gorgeous landscape, mountains, maybe even desert or something like that. But out in the solar system, on another planet or on a moon, would our aesthetic sense, would our experience of awe and wonder be different?
Well, here I think you can go back to the 18th century because mountains were not regarded as beautiful. So Burke and the other philosophers of the 18th century talk about the sublime. So the beautiful has to do with shapeliness and symmetry and with the human face and figure. When you look at a mountain through the Middle Ages, they were just seen as horrible wastelands where God had forgotten what to do. And then in the Romantic period, they became sublime, where you have not quite beauty, but a combination of beauty and terror, that your senses are telling you this is dangerous. And you get this thrilling sensation that is not beauty, but is the sublime. So in the solar system, you've got a very sublime place.
Right, because, I mean, you could die at any time. If your oxygen support system goes out, you're dead right away.
Exactly. Your senses will tell you that. You'll be looking around going, okay, there's no Earth. I'm out there in space. I could die if the technology breaks down. It's like being in a submarine or even in scuba gear.
So as a science fiction writer, do you feel like you have a particular mission to... Not just you, but just science fiction writers in general have a mission to sort of imagine what our future might be like. Is that part of what your job is?
Yes, I think that's central to the job. What I think science fiction is good at is doing scenarios. It's not necessarily true that science fiction will ever predict what really is going to happen in the future, because that's too hard. And strange things happen, contingent things happen that can't be predicted. But at this moment, we can see that there's trajectories. At this moment, we can see futures that are complete catastrophes, where we cause a mass extinction event, we cook the planet, 90% of humanity dies because we run out of food, or we think we're going to run out of food, and then we fight over it. In other words, complete catastrophe. On the other hand, there's another scenario where we get hold of our technologies and our social systems and our sense of justice and law, and we make, in effect, a kind of utopia, a positive future where everybody on the planet is at adequacy or better, and we're sustainable over the long haul. And so from this moment in history, both of those are completely conceivable.
So do we as a society need those positive visions of the future? I mean, not just for the science fiction geeks out there who like to read this stuff, but for society in general. I mean, do we need people to create visions of how things might go well?
Oh, yes. Yes, sure. And ever since Thomas More's Utopia, we've always had it. Edward Bellamy wrote a book called Looking Backwards from the Year 2000, and the progressive political movement in the United States that changed things around the time of Teddy Roosevelt comes out of a utopian novel called Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy. And like, say the fascination with Steve Jobs or with Bill Gates are thinking, oh my gosh, that's sort of like one of these geeky 1950s science fiction things where a kid in his backyard makes a rocket that goes to the moon or in his garage makes a computer that changes everything. We love these stories because they're hopeful and they suggest that we could do things, that we could seize history and change it for the better. So it's like Steve Jobs is a science fiction story that we want.
Kim Stanley Robinson is the award-winning author of The Mars Trilogy, and he and Steve were talking about his latest book, Aurora. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed, so why not add us to your playlist? You'll find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Home base for To the Best of Our Knowledge is Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Paulson put this hour together with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Now go outside, look at the stars, and imagine the future.
PRI, Public Radio International.